One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello everyone. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm your host, Tom Daly. For today's episode, I was fortunate enough to be able to connect with the host of The History of China, Chris Stewart. After I'd finished The History of Rome and was casting about for something to fill the space on my iPod, I thought to myself, how about that other great empire in history, China? During my search, I was confronted by choices, to be sure, but there was only one podcaster that I could see that was developing a comprehensive, chronological narrative for the 5,000 years of Chinese history, and that was Chris. And what a storyteller he turned out to be. Over the course of 100 episodes and counting, Chris has taken his listeners on a trip down the proverbial Silk Road and entertained with stories of mythical emperors, oracle bones, lakes of mercury, boiling vats of wine, fractured empires, warring kingdoms, learned bureaucrats, devious eunuchs, Confucian legalists, and Buddhist warriors. Throughout it all, the history of China has managed neither to get bogged down nor simply gloss over the important aspects of its subject matter, and Chris does a superb job distilling an ancient and sometimes mysterious culture and making it digestible to Western listeners who might otherwise be deterred by its unfamiliar names, unknown geography, and complex motivations. So ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to have you join me now, like digital age Mongols, as we breach the Great Firewall of China. Today I'm speaking with Chris Stewart, the creator and host of the History of China podcast, who is also the Agora Podcaster of the Month for June 2016. And he is joining me from the future, from his home in Shanghai. Chris, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me. The future is now, here on the eastern side of the world.
Awesome. So, I like to jump right in. And I want to, I don't know if I'm blowing your cover here, because I don't know what presumptions listeners may have, but you are an American, born and bred in Montana, is that correct?
That's right, Southwest Montana, where the cows outnumber the people multiple times over.
I guess the first question, you know, I want to ask is sort of why China for you? And so let me give a little background to that question. So I think we're of a similar age, come from this, you know, a homogenous enough American culture.
Yeah.
So growing up in the 1980s, I remember the great emphasis being on Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, between, say, Nintendo, the auto industry, you know, Michael Keaton's Gung Ho, of course.
Oh, yes.
And I recall even into the 90s, people saying, Japanese, learn Japanese. Like, that's the language and the culture that we're going to need to, you know, really understand to win the future. So how does a gentle cowherd like yourself from Montana come to embrace Chinese culture and language and life, essentially?
All right. Well, that's a great starter question. And it's a winding tale. So let me try to boil it down to its constituent parts here. Once I got to the age of majority and went to university, I left Montana. I went to Portland, Oregon, where East Asian culture is a lot stronger. Both Japanese and Chinese, there's a lot of immigration that's happened there as well. And I went to a school there. And I, throughout high school and middle school, I'd taken French language, and I had about as much knowledge of Japan or China as you might expect someone from Montana to have, which was functionally nothing. But I'd gotten tired of French. I decided that it was just too easy, and I needed something a little bit more challenging. Yeah, that was my 18-year-old hubris. So the school that I went to, like a lot of them out there, they offered the standard, you know, European languages. But then they also offered Japanese language and Chinese language. And it was just really on a lark that I opted for taking Mandarin rather than Japanese. The Japanese program was the larger program. It was more pushed. But I thought, why not go against the current? And almost for no other reason than that, I just decided to start taking a language class here or there with no basis whatsoever. So then, based off that, I found that I could actually do the language okay enough, in large part because I played a lot of music in high school and even got a scholarship into university. And so Chinese is a tonal language, which makes it especially difficult for everybody. But a lot of people, they have real significant problems even effectively hearing the tone or being able to replicate them, which makes both understanding and speaking difficult. But I was able to pretty easily and naturally pick it up, as my mom would say, from my musical ear. So I was able to kind of coast by on that as a C student in Chinese. And that ended up turning into, I got a little bit more interested into the culture, took a few classes here and there, and eventually got the opportunity to take a trip in 2006 or 2007. So I got to go to China, got to see all over the place, and decided, wow, this is actually a pretty cool place. I'd like to, you know, continue learning more about it. Then my senior year, my advising professor, because I was a history major, he ended up saying, hey, to me and a few other people that he knew at the school, because it was a very small school, about 2,000 or so undergrads, hey, I know this school in a place in China, it's southern China, this town you've never heard of called Wenzhou. And there's a university there, they don't pay a lot, but you know, you could just go there for a year, and I know you're interested in it, so what do you think? And I was thinking, well, I don't have anything else to do. So I said yes. And I thought, okay, well, I'll just be here a year. I can do anything for a year, right? And I went to there and wound up meeting a beautiful woman who ended up becoming my wife. And here I am.
So that's how you moved to China.
That's the whole story.
Okay. That's sort of funny. I ended up in Massachusetts similarly. That's where my wife was from. It's just funny how people's migrations, I guess, tend to maybe follow a pattern in that way.
The things we do for love.
Yeah, exactly. So what was the process like in actually moving and taking residency in China?
Oh, a process is a really good way to describe it, I think. it is a very large culture shock, and especially where I initially moved to. Like I said, it was a city that no one outside of China's probably ever heard of. Very famous within China for being very wheely-dealy, very business-like, very trade and export-oriented. And I think probably the thing that the Wenzhouese are most known for, besides their completely incomprehensible language, is moving out of China to Europe and living there. Maybe not the majority, but I think the plurality of overseas Chinese living in Western Europe are from or around the city of Wenzhou. But it's classified as a tier 3 city, meaning that it is not Beijing, it is not Shanghai, it's not even Hangzhou or Suzhou. It's a level below that. It's very provincial. It's got basic amenities, but it takes a long time to get used to the idea of the drop in the relative standard of living. And I think the process is pretty similar. I've talked to a lot of people about this before, who likewise live here. And it's, you start out and everything's amazing and exotic and, you know, I'm going to try everything. I'm going to, you know, be just the eyes wide open foreigner who's going to live it up. And that drops off after about, 3 months or so, where all that exoticness starts to wear off and life just started starts to get normal, and all those kooky, crazy little things that all the locals do are no longer kooky and crazy. They're just obnoxious, and why can't these people just be normal? And that lasted for me, at least, throughout the remainder of the first year. And there's never quite a point where you're like, and, you know, click, and okay, now I feel much better about it. It's just sort of from that bottoming out, either people say, well, the heck with this, and then they pack their bags and go home, because it's just, I miss home, I don't like it here anymore, and I'm tired of it. Or some people, like myself, are crazy enough to kind of ride it out, and by the end of the first year, you're like, okay, it doesn't bother me as much, I can kind of figure this out. And it's just this process of, over time, you just get more and more used to the little eccentricities. And I mean, this is not only in China. This is anywhere, any other culture you'd ever go and live in. You deal with some level or another of this same sort of cultural adaptation, and it's just a process of time. But then I occasionally will fly back to the U.S., and it's the reverse. It's reverse culture shock, and it's a very real thing of like, wait, the cars are stopping for me? I mean, usually they just go around me. What's wrong? Is something wrong?
I never thought of that. I never thought about the shock coming back to visit might have on somebody. That's really fascinating.
Oh yeah, it's. I mean, traffic's probably the most obvious example, just because it's a completely different mindset, both as a driver and as a pedestrian in China. It doesn't matter where you are, you're playing a game of Frogger whenever you cross the street.
God. Well, yeah, definitely sounds like it was a process getting acculturated there, but now, you know, you're all set, you're like a native.
No, I'm not like a native, but I'm acclimatized enough that I can get by, and that I just can kind of roll my eyes and be like, it's always like this whenever something gets too obnoxious. But that said, you know, I went from a tier 3 city and then upgraded to Shanghai, which is, you know, tier 1 international hub, you know, city with all the amenities. So would I want to go back and downgrade? No, I don't think I could make that transition a second time. I was able to do it when I was, you know, in my early 20s, but now I'm in my early 30s, and I'm not sure I'd want to go through that whole ordeal again.
All right, let's switch gears and let's talk about the history of China.
Yeah.
So the history of China is in its second year and enjoys the special podcasting distinction of having over 1 million downloads and 100 episodes, which to me is, I don't know, let's see, to use an analogy that will baffle non-Americans, it's like winning the Cy Young and the MVP award in the same year. So what, if anything, do these types of accomplishments mean?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'm trying to work out what exactly that means for myself, even now. Your listeners may or may not know, when you say we just hit the 100 episode mark, that literally just happened in the past week. So it's a new experience for me as well. The million download mark happened a little while ago, but that's likewise. Both of those, in their own ways, they kind of blow my mind. I started this project out just as kind of a, well, let's see what I can do with this, you know, kind of a, let's see if this has legs. And it turns out it does have legs. And I'm as surprised as anybody that I made it to 100 episodes. And it's certainly a moment that's very proud. But at the same time, I look at where I am in terms of the whole narrative arc and how far there is left to go. And it's also kind of daunting of hit 100 episodes and I'm only in the year 750, you know, wow, how much further do I have to go? But I definitely will say that in terms of the listener base that I've been able to accumulate so far, they have been the source of inspiration of getting through those moments. And by moments, I can mean days and sometimes weeks of slog and just like, ugh, do I really want to do this? And it's the fact that I keep getting listener feedback and people saying, hey, where's the next show? I can't wait for it. These kind of things, that's what definitely has always gotten me through it. If I had put this show out and I'd gotten 12 downloads. I might have done it for a few episodes, but I think it would have eventually just kind of fallen by the wayside as life got busier. But definitely the type of people who listen and the fact that they are so, when they get into it, they get really into it and they are very encouraging. That's definitely been more than enough to keep me going. Obviously, 100 episodes now, and I'm excited to keep going.
Now, China often promotes itself as unique for possessing 5,000 years of continuous civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Is this really a valid distinction?
Absolutely not.
Yes, I was going to say, you have to add so many caveats to make that remotely true that it really strips that claim of significance. I mean, you look at Egypt. Egypt still has Egyptians living there. You know, Mesopotamia has been in the business of civilization just as long as, well, there's been civilization. Yeah, so that claim is a bit self-serving in a way, isn't it?
Oh, it's completely politicized, and it's always has been. It is, well, exactly as you say, it's self-serving, and it's a way to take multiple different kingdoms and empires and nation-states that oftentimes did not have the same culture or even the same ethnicity ruling over them, and saying, lumping them all together in this overarching, oh, well, that's all us. No, it's not. I mean, I know that I use that in my tagline, the 5,000 years of Chinese history, because, you know, it works. It's a good hook, I gotta say. It's I can't blame them for it. But certainly as I've been going through the early history of China divides and fractures and is invaded by the northern steppe tribes who then rule over them for 400 years. It's like, that's, in no other instance would we consider that, oh, that's one continuous civilization. However, I will say that I can also see where they're coming from in that highly politicized sort of statement, in that even though they have multiple different peoples and ethnicities ruling over the different parts of this land, most of the time the invaders have come in. They've then really done their best to try to Sinicize. They've tried to become more Chinese and adopt the Chinese culture, the Confucian ethic and the legalist and cultural ethos of the Chinese. And that's true of the Xiongnu, that's true of the Xianbei, it's true of the Mongols when they show up, and the Khitan, and even the Manchus. They all adopted many of the Chinese customs. So in that sense, you had these people come into this land, take over, and then they became Chinese. So I guess in kind of a sense, if you squint and you look at it from a certain angle, then the culture, I suppose, is quite continuous.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Even if the political bodies definitely are not.
No, I think you've done a really terrific job so far, you know, getting your arms around that really big and sprawling history of the Middle Kingdom. And right now you're recording through the Tang Dynasty at the moment. Now, I guess I wanted to ask kind of an incredibly dull question about sources. Now, one of the great strengths of China has been its long existence of a literate bureaucracy, including various official historians from time to time. So, am I wrong to presume that there's lots of primary source material for you? And if there are these always useful for the story that you want to tell, or are they just there to supplement the narrative?
So the primary sources can be useful, and I use them quite a bit, but they can only be useful in a certain way and taking into account certain limitations that they have, which I don't think is just a issue with Chinese primary sources. It's true of, I think, any historical primary source. I've been castigated for using Procopius as a primary source, for instance, and taking him too much at face value rather than taking into account his own biases and prejudices and the like when discussing like silk moths and the Silk Road. And the same is true with Chinese historians. And then you also have to take into account that they're being written in a dynasty about the preceding dynasties. And so right there already you have this politicization of it, in that it's in the current dynasty's interests to throw the previous dynasties into a negative light and justify them having taken over through rebellion and revolution, however and whenever that may have come about. Oh, well, they were bad, their emperors were bad and lazy and, you know, rape happy, and so we came in and we saved the day.
Yeah. The previous has to lose the mandate.
Exactly. The previous dynasty must lose the mandate, and that is an entirely navel-gazing, backwards-looking, self-justifying principle in its very nature. You never lose the mandate ahead of time. You've always lost it after the rebellion wins. Then that is also, this similar point is that these histories are written 300, 500 years after the fact a lot of the time. Right now, when I'm researching the Tang Dynasty, one of the major primary sources on it is called the Zizhe Tongjian, or the Mirror on Effective Governance. But it was written in the Song Dynasty in the 10th century, and it's talking about the 6th and 7th and 8th centuries. So it's this huge time gap, and so you lose a lot there. It's not somebody who's just writing down whatever he sees. It's somebody who's compiling a bunch of other stuff into this political document. In fact, the Tang Dynasty is kind of interesting because that's where we get this real explosion in poetry at the time, which is actually a primary source. You have a lot of historical figures and their works having survived. And it's this poetry. It's very, you know, artistically done, and you can only draw so much out of it. But you can kind of start to see, in a way that you really couldn't before, the way that people felt about the events and ideas that were going on at the time. You can get this feeling of a real person sitting there feeling something, rather than somebody 300 years after the fact just compiling narratives and saying, oh, well, we'll put this in and we'll leave that out.
I have to say, me personally, over the last 5 years or so, I've tried to make a really concerted effort to learn more about where China's coming from, just to try to understand the modern world better. And I've noticed, and it could just be me, but there always seems to be a disconnect when it comes to forming an understanding of the personalities of the Chinese emperors. And it's not because I can't relate to being a divine absolute monarch, because I totally can. But I feel like they emerge from history as almost more two-dimensional, whereas, say, with the Roman emperors, I find that I can connect with them on a more human level, I guess. Particularly Marcus Aurelius or somebody like that, who you get his meditations and his own personal thoughts. Now, I'm wondering, since you kind of have a foot in two worlds, so to speak, now is this just a product of cultural differences, or is it something that you've noticed too?
Yes, I will say that it's kind of some of all of that. There is the major cultural difference, and the one that I'd really point out is that these Chinese emperors, if they were any good at least, they tried to rule from the Confucian ethos. And what that is, that's markedly different than, you know, the MO of the Roman emperors or the kings of the Greek city-states, and that they're very active figures in public life a lot of the time. For the Confucian emperors, if you're really doing your job well, then goodness just flows from you, and you shouldn't have to do anything at all. And because you're so good and so righteous, the rest of the society will likewise be. And so you can just sit there basically motionless and and good will flow from you out to the rest of society. That's not to say that that's what Chinese emperors typically actually did. They weren't just sitting there doing nothing. Some of them were. I should point that out. Some of them did basically just sit there and drink wine and have 5,000 concubines and live the life right up until they get assassinated. But for the most part, if we really get into it and dig into it, they did do a lot of things, and we can make comparisons to, you know, more Western European kind of monarchs, but it does take some digging. And that's, I think that goes back to what we were talking about in the primary source question of they're written about in a very two-dimensional fashion. A lot of the classical histories, they are purposely portraying them as kind of caricatures. This one was a good one that we should hold up as the paragon of virtue and good governance. In the case of Gaozong of Tang, for instance, or indeed the current emperor I'm on, Xuanzong, who's Gaozong's grandson. Both of them are held up as like, these guys were really good, and they always did the right thing. And then you have the other extreme, which is, you know, this guy is a depraved lunatic, and we need to get rid of him and his line as quickly as possible. And there's just not a whole lot of room left in these old texts for nuance. And that's actually where I've come to appreciate more and more the more modern histories and their takes on it, and them doing a lot of the legwork for me to put together a more three-dimensional look at this person as a human and as a fallible and three-dimensional person as we all are and as we all always have been. None of us are two-dimensional caricatures, really. But it's easy, especially if it's a literary convention, to write them as such.
So this kind of leads me to my next question. So what are the most challenging aspects of communicating Chinese history to a largely Western English-speaking audience?
Well, right off the bat, I would have to say the names. The names are really hard, and that's people's names, that's place names, that's event names. You've heard of Marcus Aurelius, you've heard of Augustus Caesar, you've heard of the Romanov dynasty or the Bourbons. All of these are pretty familiar names to anyone who's taken a high school history class or maybe even a middle school history class. We even know more kind of exotic names like, you know, King Tut or, you know, Emperor Hirohito or the like. Japanese has managed to percolate into American cultural understanding at a much higher level than Chinese has. And, I mean, that's not trying to say that that American or European cultural ethos is trying to be unfair to Chinese history. But it's just, as I said, kind of when we were discussing the language and the difficulty of that, it is a really hard language to learn and to wrap one's brain around and even a real basic surface level. And then the fact that, okay, so I can now remember Emperor Wu. Well, which one?
So many.
You get the same repeated names over and over again with just these different little tweaks. I don't know of any emperors who were twerking. Sorry.
I'm sure there were one or two.
I have to think so. which of the 57 different Emperor Wus should I remember this time? It's very difficult, and I don't blame anyone for having done so. So that is something that is a definite challenge to overcome. Place names will tend to change over time. Like, it used to be called Beijing, but now it's Beijing. But we might know it as Peking, and you know, that's just the most simple example of it. And so what I've been trying to do, and I think I've gotten better over time, is trying to simplify that down. Like, whoever the Chinese emperor du jour is will have 6 or 7 different names, but I'm only going to give you one, and I'm going to stick with that one, and just so that we can all be very clear about who we're talking about. And I've also really tried to pare down the character lists. Chinese histories, they love to give dozens upon dozens upon dozens of characters, because that was court life. You had dozens and dozens of different officials waiting upon the imperial family hand and foot, and everyone who's included was deemed to be very important, and rightfully so. But I have to go through with my American brain thinking for a Western audience and say, okay, well, do we really need to hear about this guy once and then he'll never show up again? No, he's cut. He's out. So it is a simplification process, and I'm probably not giving some people their due. But I think that's been a necessary step in trying to make it relatable and something that people can sit down and say, okay, I'm coming into this with limited or no prior knowledge, and I can sit down and feel like I can at least get the bones of what's going on at this time and place.
All right. So we're gonna start to wind it down here. So you've got about 1,400 years of history left to talk about. What are you most looking forward to covering, or have you already covered your favorite period?
It's a very good question. Actually, this event that's is going to be coming up in very short order. I'm actually beginning my research into it now. This could be one of my favorite, most interesting events. It's called the An Lushan or the An Shi Rebellion, and it starts in the year 755. And what it is this massively powerful general who's come into control of basically the entire northeastern army, and has been using it against the Khitan tribes of the northeast for decades. And he's a personal good friend of the emperor at the time. Well, he's going to decide that, he should be the emperor now. And so he's going to take his army under his personal command, this massive force, which dwarfs the direct imperial army, and he's going to turn it against it. He's going to declare himself the son of heaven, and he's going to wage a civil war, the likes of which has dwarfed everything up until the First and Second World Wars. To this day, you can't put a real clear number on the number of people involved, but it's thought of oftentimes as being the third largest conflict in history after the two world wars. So that's going to be something I'm already very excited about. I've been kind of throwing hints into the narrative as we've been going on, but we're going to get into that, and I'm very excited about that. Then I'm also very excited about, once we get into the conquest of China by the Mongols. I mean, it's a sad story from the Chinese perspective, of course, but it's very exciting from a historical vantage point. I know that's already been done by some others, but I'm hoping I can make it look at it from a slightly different angle. And then probably the third bit that I'm probably most interested in, that I don't even know when I'm possibly going to get that far ahead, but when we get into the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and we get the dissolution of the imperial system, we have yet more massive rebellions, and then the Japanese invasions, the First and Second World Wars, the establishment of the People's Republic. That's also a very complicated but very exciting and very interesting time period. So whenever I get to any of those, and I no promises on how quickly or slowly those are going to be able to come about, but those are probably my three big moments that I'm most looking forward to.
Oh, wait, great. That actually flows right into, the last question was, where were you hoping to land this podcast in the end? I was wondering if you would get into the People's Republic and talk about the Great Leap Forward or even Tiananmen Square, or, where do you see this wrapping up?
Yeah, that's a very good question that is still up in the air for me. I have every intent of going up through at least the formation of the PRC, possibly as late as the Tiananmen. I think convention, at least a lot of the time, states, you really shouldn't be going any later than 20 years ago. Shouldn't be going any closer to the present than about two decades, because at that point you lose basically all historicity and it all becomes political and very heated. And that's kind of that's even more true, I think, with Chinese history, because there's a long cultural memory that people still get very heated and emotionally worked up about, even 80, 90, 100 years after the fact. So it is a question that I'm still, well, it's still up in the air, and I'm not having to decide by tomorrow or anything, but I'm probably a few years out before I have to really make any hard decisions about that.
This is true. Well, that's fair enough. So, Chris, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I loved our conversation. Did you want to plug anything before we go?
Well, I suppose, as I said a little bit earlier, we have the 100th episode that just got released. That's a question and answer episode where listeners sent in questions, including one from you, Tom, which was very good, and I had a lot of fun answering that.
Yeah, my questions are the best questions.
They are. And that was on Chinese alcohol. But if any of the listeners want a starting point and just a place where they can kind of jump into the feel of the show and not have to worry about background, that's very much kind of a one-off show that is just taking whatever questions listeners gave. So I think maybe they should give that one a try.
Sounds good. All right, Chris. Well, thanks again, and you have a great day.
You too.
Okay, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that talk with Chris Stewart. If you don't already listen to The History of China, you really should. I don't think you'll be disappointed. You can find The History of China on iTunes, Acast, and probably a dozen other places that I'm not even aware. But you can always go check out the website, thehistoryofchina.wordpress.com. And just a brief bit of business on the tail end here before we go today. If you enjoy listening to the Agora Podcast Network's original content, why not consider leaving an iTunes review? As producers, it's always nice to get feedback, particularly good feedback, and your reviews will help Agora get noticed by that mysterious iTunes algorithm. So, if you have a few spare moments, we'd really appreciate it. All right. Thanks for listening, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.